We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
It was mentioned to me the idea of continuing on a little longer in this series, and while it's a great pleasure to do so, I think it was a great encouragement in doing so in the number of people who came on Friday to hear about what is a Christian and how to become one, and to see the many people who in that meeting came to understand and commit themselves to Christ, and to perceive what has actually been happening in the last couple of weeks on our campus here in people coming to a new way of life, a new relationship with God, and hearing of some of the changes that takes place in people's lives and is taking place in people's lives. And I must confess, even to some gladness, at seeing the graffiti warfare as I just walk very briefly across the campus at the moment, and to perceive the troubled state of some of the people involved in Satanism, which is such a very undercover organisation on the campus, but whose capacity now for defacing our university shows the irritation that is taking place in the hearts of some people, that some lives are being changed here by God. That is actually an extraordinary thing that is taking place. Lives being changed is a rare enough thing, but lives being changed by God in our context is a very exciting and marvellous thing to take place, and I'm glad it is, and I'm glad to be back here with you. And it's because of the very pain that comes to many people in this area of life, namely sex, that I want you to speak about Christ and sex this time. Because I'm really speaking about Christ, and I'm not making any pretense about that otherwise. It's not just to talk about sex that I'm here for. You can go to your biology lessons any time you want to. I'm talking about Christ. But I'm saying that Christ is not remote from life. Christ is to be commended to people, to be believed upon, because he is true. But he is not only true, he is massively relevant to our life. And there's very few areas of life which are more personal, more problematic for those of us who are still struggling out of school and under 50 or 60 or 70 or whatever it is that you actually kind of lose the strength for sexual motivations. I understand you don't at all until you die. Thank you. Well, I'm glad I know what I was talking about. Let me start again. It is a great pleasure here that, Christ is very relevant to our lives and relevant even in this area of life, as in every area, but I'm picking it up in this area particularly. You see, you don't have to be a great historian to recognise that we have come to an age of greater sexual freedom than our immediate predecessors. It's not that we're the first age or culture that has had such sexual freedom. There has been a great pendulum swinging down through the ages of history. But there is an acceptance in our community at the moment, in our structures, in our society, an acceptance of a wide variety of sexual behaviour, literature, discussion, eroticism and so forth. And people have much more choice about their sexual expression now than they have had for some time. This has come not without great cost and difficulty for people, but it has come, and it now enables us to gain more information, more counselling, more literature, more technical facts than possibly ever before, at least in our culture of recent centuries. But it's beginning to be noticed that it also comes with greater need for counselling and help, that people actually are in difficulty in the area. No subject, of course, has got greater interest, especially to an undergraduate audience, I've noticed, but no subject arouses really greater heartache, greater insecurity and unhappiness and need for counselling. counsellors who can actually now get a good living out of just hanging your plate up anywhere, whether or not you're qualified. Counsellors have got a great business, but so much of it is caught up with sexual difficulties and sexual problems and sexual-based problems. Now, it may be just the counsellors have all been fairly carefully versed in Freud so as to be looking for it, or it could be that the society is in great need of it. We may have more counsellors, but we also seem to have more need for counsellors. But it's not the society that I want to talk to. I'm not interested altogether in talking to society, but society doesn't listen to me ultimately anyway. We never can get anything into the media. It's just a factor of life here. No matter what press releases we ever send, they never get published. That's just the character of life at Sydney University. And it's fairly true also in the local student magazines too. Why, they even lost our advertisement down at Onisoir this last series of meetings. I mean, it's just the character and pattern of it. Now, I'm not talking to society, I'm talking to you. Because in the end, it's not a society problem, it's a you problem, it's a my problem. See, in the end, we are the sexual beings, and we are the ones who are making decisions, and we are the ones who are being hurt by other people, and hurting other people, and hurting within ourselves. We're the ones with the insecurities, and with the overconfidence, and we're the ones with the heartaches, and with the joys, and the pleasures, and the excitements. I mean, I'm talking to individuals, I hope, today. I'm talking to you about it. Because the Bible has such tremendous things to say about it, and we are in a sea of shifting, confused values, of innumerable Women's Weekly descriptions of what we should, shouldn't do, and Women's Weekly, which comes out monthly, gives it to you all the time, as does Women's Day, which comes out weekly. And most of us learn from the Reader's Digest and the back of the toilet doors. And what we learn and what we hear and what we feel is not really an area in which we get help. Now, the Bible is a tremendous help. I'm going to talk of the Bible because I'm talking about Christ under four headings. And I'm going to challenge you to be Christians again. Each day, it never changes the same. If you actually look inside, you'll see the bottom of the inside of the sheet here. The bottom part's a prayer. I'm going to pray it again because I want people to become Christians, and it's fantastically exciting to see that so many people have in these last 2 weeks. And I'm trying to be helpful to those who have become Christians recently to talk to you on a very important subject, but I'm actually going to be challenging you to become Christians, those who are not. And I'm going to be doing it, speaking about Christ, because he is the centre of what Christianity is all about, speaking about Christ, but illustrating what I'm saying from the whole area of sex. That is, I'm going to be talking about a disease, a real fundamental disease, a diseased relationship with God. But I'm going to illustrate it by a symptom. I could have illustrated from all kinds of symptoms, from work, from leisure and rest, from pleasure, from sport. I could illustrate it from car driving. I'm going to illustrate it from something that really matters to most of us, that is sex. But the sex is just the symptoms. It's the disease I'm really talking about. What's it about? Four themes I'm going to put forward to you that are all in the Bible, and I'm going to read bits of the Bible to you to show that they're in the Bible. The first one is the theme of creation. That God has made the world and everything in the world, and looking upon the world, he declared it to be good, very good. The Bible never envisages that this material universe is evil, is bad, or is a mistake. And the Bible therefore never envisages that the pleasures of this world are evil and a mistake. Some other groups, of course, do hold that kind of view. I mean, if you follow out your Krishna doctrines, you'll see that actual sex is really something that's bad. Because physical pleasures are really things that are distractions from spiritual reality. That's a very different view to the Bible's view. The Bible's view is that the world itself is good, and that the physical pleasures of the world are good. Eating is good and to be enjoyed, those of you who are at the moment. It is to be enjoyed. And the Bible actually says that those who preach against the enjoyment of food are the devil. Extraordinary, isn't it? Very strong statement. Because the Bible actually believes in creation, in God making a world that is good. And part of the world that he made was good is sex. And sexual pleasures, and they also say those who deny and forbid marriage as being less of a religious state, are also preaching the doctrines of the devils. Extraordinary, isn't it? It's not what you expect the Bible to be saying if you've never read the Bible. Look at the first quotation for me there, and you'll see how God looks at man, sees he has need for him, and creates woman. The man said, "Now this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. And for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his flesh, united to his wife, and that they will become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." God, in his creation, created the relationship of man and woman as a sexual relationship which they are to share freely and openly, naked, without any shame, united together, physically united together in the sexual act, so that they become one flesh. That is, God's view of mankind is to see the basic unit of humanity as being a man and a woman in a sexual relationship. And that is part of the good creation in the Garden of Eden. That is a part of paradise. The Bible is very pro-sex in its attitude. It is to be received with enjoyment. Sex is part of the creation, part of the blessings of God by which we can reproduce. Yet it's not only just for reproduction, it's also for the need for fellowship and relationship. It links, it unites, it ties together, it brings together, it bonds together the man and his mate, the woman and her mate. It brings them together. It's a good thing for our enjoyment, and we are to enjoy it. It's not an end in itself. Sex is not the ultimate goal of life. It is a means to an end. It's a means to deepening your relationship with your partner. It's a means to the production of children. It's a means to an end, not an end itself. Look at it, for example, in the second quotation from a different part of the Old Testament. "The Lord is acting as the witness between you and the wife of your youth, because you have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. Has not the Lord made them one? In flesh and spirit they are his. And why one? Because he was seeking godly offspring. So guard yourself in your spirit and do not break faith with the wife of your youth." God makes the man and the woman to have unity, to be united. He knits them together. He makes them one. One in person, one in being. They become the unit. And why? Well, amongst other things, so as to provide the right context for the offspring. Oh, you can have children without that kind of unity, but the very unity that God makes is the context in which to bring up children in safety and security, both psychologically, personally and spiritually. To actually have that context of parents who love each other is a great principle of life, of course. The best way to treat your children is to love your marriage partner. You love their mother, you love their father. That's the great principle of how to raise your children. For as the bond is warm and developed, as the relationship is warm and open, a relationship which is physical and sexual, as that relationship is working well, so the children are in a context in which they can grow and develop in stability and security and safety and godliness. See, God actually wants the partners to enjoy their life. And what he is criticising there through the prophet Malachi is the way in which people were turning away from their partner. But that's more of another section of the talk. You will see that sex is the good that God has created. Let me try and make the point even further with the next quotation, because the next one comes from the Apostle Paul. And everybody outside Christianity portrays Paul as being a woman-hater, a wowser, a Puritan, a killjoy, someone who never wanted anybody to ever enjoy themselves, especially over something like sex. But, of course, that's by people who have never read him. Read him this time and see. "The husband should fulfil his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body doesn't belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourself to prayer. But then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." See, he recognises our physical need, our sexual need. And he says, don't deprive your partner, because you have need of each other, to serve each other. And so Paul actually enjoins us to have sex with our partner often. That is what he is. That doesn't sound a killjoy to me. That is one of the great pleasures of life. What a marvellous thing that if you're a Christian, you are encouraged, you are commanded to have sex with your partner regularly. It is a Christian view, you see, of the creation, of God's good gift to mankind. This unity that comes in the bonding together. And you're not to ever deny your partner because you are your partner's. You are, you see. It's not you to deprive. That's robbing your partner. You're each to serve each other in providing for each other's sexual needs. And only ever to stop by mutual agreement, and then only for a limited period of time, and for a very good reason, like something like praying. You want to pray for a while. You want to have time for specific reasons, you see. But then, limited is the time. Get back together. The Bible sees sex as the good thing that God has created for us to develop our relationships and to have children. Great blessing from God to enjoy. I say, while we see terrible statistics about divorce and all the rest of it, remember the vast majority of mankind do have that kind of partnership and relationship. And I can testify, after I've forgotten how many years of marriage, that it's marvellous. I'm only a newcomer on it. I think I've only been married about 15 years. But you can meet people who have been married 30 years, 50 years, and they love each other, and it works. I know it's got problems, and that's what I want to go on to deal with. That is the second theme. First theme is God's creation and his generosity to us. The second theme is the rebellion of man against God. Is rebellion. We dealt with this, of course, in the last couple of weeks, especially the series on the one on Adam and Eve, and you can get tapes. There's tape order forms here if you missed those talks to pick up about it. And I want to go all over it again. But you see, the whole nature of what took place in the Garden of Eden was man saying no to God. It was humanity rejecting God as being God over them, doing our own thing. No one's going to run my life and tell me how to live. I'm going to run my own life and do my own thing. Now, friends, sex is seen by people as being central to sin, and that is both right and wrong. Let me deal why it's wrong first. See, people misunderstand the Adam and Eve account as talking about sin equaling sex. And they think that Christians think sex is sin. They use the words almost interchangeably. And they think that eating the apple was having sex. Well, that, of course, is nowhere near what the story of Genesis 2 and 3 is about. You just need to go back and read it again. It's got nothing to do with that. It's not even an apple. It's the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's the desire to run your own life your own way that is involved. Sex is never seen as wrong like that. See, it's a terrible mistake to see sex as synonymous with sin. The synonym for sin is rebellion. It is rebellion against God. It is saying, no, God, rack off. I don't want you. I'm going to do my thing my way. That's what sin is. Now, you can express sin, you can express rebellion in a whole host of ways. That's the disease I'm talking about, rebellion. All kinds of symptoms. You can do it in telling lies. You can do it in the way in which you work or the way in which you don't work. And you can do it in the area of sex. Now, at this point, it's right to see that sex is very close to the heart of what sin's about, because there's hardly any area of our life that is more fundamentally me than my own sexuality. It's not something remote from me or removed from me. It is how I feel. It's how I feel about me, as well as how I feel about you. It's how I perceive life. I can't actually detach my sexuality from me. And I cannot detach sexual behaviour from myself. And therefore, one of the chief ways in which I can express my rebellion against God and do my own thing is to do it sexually. And one of the areas in which I will feel the consequences of that most is sexually, is within my very self. And so of all the areas of sin, one of the areas where I've got most potential for damaging my own very self is sexuality. And it's little wonder then that people feel it most acutely. They feel more guilty about sex rebellion against God, sex sins, than they feel about other areas of sin which are equally sinful. The Bible makes no distinction between gluttony and sex that is used wrongly. Sin's sin. But one symptom you will feel more than another. Now, how do people rebel against God in the area of sexuality. Well, there's any number of ways. The only limitation is the imagination of mankind. That is the only limitation. You see, you reject God's way. How can you reject God's way? I'll rattle off three ones quickly here for you, three areas for you. First is to actually reject the directions that God, the commands that God has given concerning sexual activity. Now, I haven't listed them out from the Bible, but you can find them easily enough. But they're all manners of expression, sexual expressions, which are directly disobedient to what God says. Rape, assault, incest, bestiality, adultery, fornication, the list goes on and on. And if you choose to express your sexuality in a way which is directly contrary to the way in which God says to use it, then of course you are rebelling against God, aren't you? Saying, well, I know God says that I'm not to commit adultery, but he doesn't live next door to this woman. What do you know about it? You know, I mean, I feel it. It's incredible. My blood pressure goes right. I mean, he hasn't got blood pressure, has he? How do you know? I know how to run my life. I'm going to do it. Right? It's rebellion against God, isn't it? That's what it's all about. It's a rejection. You say, well, look, I never even think about him. I just go and do it. It's still rejection of God. Whether you think about it or don't think about it, whether you ignore him or consciously go against him, it's still rejection. It's still sin. You reject the commands of God. The second way in which you can do it is the whole host of ways in which you misuse the sexual things that God has given to us. That is, he's given us sex for procreation and for deepening the relationship with our partner, to make us united. That's what he's given it to us for. Now, we can use it for all kinds of other reasons, can't we? And in fact, whenever we break the rules, we will be doing it for other kinds of reasons. We can do it to satisfy our own animal instincts. We can do it to exploit other people. We can do it so as to build up our own ego. We can do it so as to entertain and titillate the senses. We can do it so as to sell products. We can do it so as to blackmail and hurt our partner. We can use sex in a whole host of ways that God never gave it to us to be used. So you build your own ego, don't you? I mean, there's a whole sexual pecking order, isn't there? I mean, there's even the sophisticated one, just of fashion. Fashion's always got to do with sexuality, sexual titillation, attracting attention to yourself. And we all play the beauty game, don't we, of how attractive we are and who notices whom and who goes out dating with whom. And sex actually becomes one of the ways in which the society, especially in the particular age group you're going through, is if you're still in the dating process, the whole process of your self-esteem is caught up with your sexual attractiveness. The number of people that you can get to invite you out or be willing to go out with you. And the kind of score that you are enabled to, you can build your whole ego out of it, can't you? Your own feeling of significance and worthwhileness you can sell products by sexuality, can't you? And which of our advertisers doesn't do it? You can sell anything by the use of sexuality. Motor car, sheep drench, anything. Watch any TV commercial and you'll see it take place. There's a second area, that is to actually misuse it. And you see, can you even misuse it within marriage, can't you? It's not just, you know, you say, oh, well, I'm married to the person. I'm within the structures of what God says to do. But you can still blackmail your partner sexually. You can still say, well, you know, if you will do that, then of course I'll be friendly tonight. And there's a whole host of ways in which people can distort the good gift God's given. The third way in which we express our rebellion, Jesus points out, is our hypocrisy. And this is a crass one that so often people get caught up in. The hypocrisy of saying, well, I haven't done the actions, I've only thought the thoughts. And Jesus, in his great Sermon on the Mount, pinpoints that magnificently and says, you know, the lust in your heart, that is what it's about. It's out of your heart that the evil comes. What you want to do in your magic moments of fantasy. What you want to do, but you only refrain from doing for lack of opportunity. You know all those kinds of things? He says, don't you go around saying, well, I've never committed rape, I've never committed adultery, I've never done that wrong and this wrong and all the rest of it. When in fact I've lain abed at night planning how to and I just can't get the opportunity. There's a crass hypocrisy in that, isn't it? God has given us a wonderful thing, great thing, fun. I don't have to sell you on the magnificence of sex, do I? I mean, I'm sorry if you actually think it's nasty and evil. I don't have that problem. I think it's marvellous. capacity of my body for enjoyment is just fantastic. And God's given it. God's made me that way. And he's made me that way to share it with my wife, that in the sharing of it, we are bound together in love and care and devotion, and we really care for each other and are united with each other. And he's given it that we may have our children. What a tremendous way to have children. Great motivation for having children. Fantastic thing, you see, God's got. I don't have to tell you how good it is. God's given it. But we won't use it for why God has given it. We won't use it the way God tells us to use it. We even think about it in distorted ways. Third theme of the Bible. First is that God's given us great things. Second is that we rebel against God and say, no, look, I'm going to do it my way. Third thing is the consequences, the judgment. There's the consequences. Every action you take, you'll have consequences in this life. That's the character of it. And the consequences are actually involve God. You see, you reject God, then God actually accepts your judgment. It's an extraordinary thing, really. The way in which God judges you is by letting you have your own way. You know, sometimes you can't teach kids. You tell them not to do something, and in the end you've got to stand back and say, oh, look, he's only ever going to learn the hard way. Go on, off you go. Have a go. And when he knows that he can't do it, then maybe you'll come back and ask for advice and listen. There comes a point at which the only way you're going to teach a person, God actually has stood back and said, okay, you don't want me? You go ahead without me. At the moment, he's still in the background. In this world, he's still in the background. That's why we have such a crazy mixture of good and evil in this world, because God's still in the background. But the day comes, the day of death, when actually he's no longer even in the background. At the moment, we feel the consequences of trying to run our world our own way, and they're lousy, as I'll show you in a few moments. But there's something worse down the track, the day when even the good things are taken away. See, what are the consequences of man trying to run his own life, his own way? Well, just a little, I'll illustrate it again from sex. Can do it from anywhere, but I'll do it from there again. The consequences are obvious. As you look at the result of rape, of incest, of interference, the psychological, psychiatric damage that is done to people by the way in which they're treating each other in this very area that is so much personal, and you know it, friends. My trouble with speaking to you is while I'm speaking on principles and can sound very hard, I know just statistically that some of you have been through it, that some of you have been raped, that some of your parents did interfere with you. And you know that terrible feelings and angst that goes through your soul because of what people have done to you. And some of you know that you've done it to others. And you know what it is that we're talking about. It's a dreadful thing that is ripping. 1/3 of the marriages in Australia now ending in divorce. That's not talking about the ones that don't go to the divorce courts. They're the ones that legally dissolve. 1/3. Divorce is not something out there, friends. Many of you have suffered from it because your parents have. You are the innocent victims of the whole thing, aren't you? But the poor children of it so often feel the responsible parties to it. So often are caught up in their own difficulties. The mounting evidence of the effects upon children of the dissolution of marriage is dreadful. What our society is going to reap in the coming generations, we have no idea of. But when you do any statistical surveys on the people who are in problems, the high percentage of them that come from the broken home must scream out to our social planners, although it doesn't seem to. So hell-bent are we on living in a society where we can break our covenant, break our contract, where we can break open the partner. And have you seen the process of breaking open the partnership? Have you been through divorce counselling in your family or seen it close quarters? They actually talk in the classic divorce counselling case books these days, they talk about people going through the normal insanity period. For the couple of years after the divorce, that's what they are. They just are mad. They go and do all kinds of strange things, right out of character, right out of keeping, because a very part of their being has been cut out of them. They were one with another and now they've been ripped open by it. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. He's been divorced about 6 or 7 years now and he was laughing about his normal insanity period. He said he never went to bed without a knife and without a gun underneath it. He said he wasn't expecting anybody to come and attack him, but he just knew that he was dreaming all the night about killing her. And he wanted to have the weapons close by. Oh man, you meet him in the street, you wouldn't pick it was like that. You would never think it was like that. Unless you've been through the home that's had it too. Little wonder you've got the problems of blowing up judges. What a horrific situation. Our society can't cope with it. We're all coming apart. We're thinking, how can it be that people are now doing it? Because we haven't understood how crucial the marriage unity is to ourselves. You can't rip people apart like that and have them still normal, have them still sane, have them still exactly the same way as they always were, let alone what it does to their children. It's a dreadful state that we're in. But we're doing it our own way, aren't we? In a crowd as big as this, there's got to be some of you who are users. Some of you who are used. In my experience of uni students, there's been some many of you who are confused. A lot of users. People who just go from one sexual conquest to the next, using people, freely moving around from person to person, pushing their own needs on others and being utterly self-centred in every sexual action and movement, developing with every conquest a hardening indifference to the people who stand around, a consistent lack of reduction of sexuality to being something akin to going to the toilet. It's just a physiological release and nothing much more. The users in our society, and I've actually expressed that in fairly masculine terms. Let me give it to you on the female users, of course, those who are so desperate for love, who keep on using men's bodies just to try and get some acceptance. Two women I know very recently, both of them pregnant, both of them dealing with the difficulties of being unmarried mothers, both of them went to bed with a fellow they didn't even really know because they just felt depressed. And they thought by having sex with someone that they would feel better. They feel kind of wanted by somebody somewhere. Dreadful circumstance to find yourself in. The user, they're users, aren't they? Then there are the used. Those who actually are idealistic. Those who gave in, who accepted the... because they had the ideal of romance in their mind that they actually thought the other person cared. But then they found they didn't care. They were just another one. For them it was life and for the other it was just a one-night stand. Dreadful case that was taking place in one of the colleges in our... I'll say one of our universities here, where they were running book on the number of first-year girls who could be bedded by which blokes before the end of the first term. They actually had it all worked out. Have you any idea what it did to the girls to find out that they were just part of a gambling scheme worked out by the fellows with all the numbers and all the names exchanged and even, okay, you can go with her now because I've finished with her, I'm moving on to the next one. All taking place within the community of the intellectual, sophisticated university world. The used. Can you imagine the devastation in depression, in lowered self-esteem? How can you still think of yourself as a worthwhile person when you've just been treated like that? How can you go with the used in our community? Or should I better call them the abused in our community? And I think the majority of uni students are frankly just confused. All around about them, they're reading the Women's Weekly and the Women's Day and other sophisticated journals like that, which tell them that you can do anything, anytime, anywhere, with anyone, and it'll always be great and it's always fun, and here's the latest techniques, and here's the, this is what you've got to go for and that, and all this. But yet they're caught up in this program of users and used. Yet they're caught up in the program of hurt and uncertainty. And they're caught up with the feelings of guilt and responsibility that I really shouldn't be doing this, but yet, of course, your biological forces are screaming out that you want to do it. If you're normal and healthy, God's still got red blood circles, you'll be wanting it. And there's no guidelines. It's interesting, the National Times put out an article, a leading article there only a couple of months ago. I rarely buy the magazine, but I bought it that Saturday because a huge article on no sex is better than bad sex. A group of the permissive people, I think it's picking up from Germaine Greer, but I haven't read Germaine, so I won't actually speak about her on the subject until I read up on that. But I did read that article. It was an interesting series of interviews with people. All the libertines, not Christians, hadn't become Christians, haven't come back to saying it's right and wrong, but they are now saying it doesn't work. Unless it's a meaningful relationship, it really is empty and vacuous. And we've been there, we've done that, and France was more interesting. And when you reach the stage of saying France was more interesting than sex, you know you're sick. The Frenchman amongst me, I'm sure, will agree. But that is what is now said, you see. They say, you can't just go on doing that and have any meaningful value in it. And lo and behold, what God said in the beginning is seen to be true. And you know it too. But of course, this is only the consequence in this world. God is still here. There are still options for you in this world. Not even as a Christian, necessarily as a non-Christian, there's still options of having a meaningful sexual relationship. There's still options of being loved and cared for and united to your partner, inside and outside of Christ, in a world which God has stood back from but not let go completely. But the day is coming when he let goes completely. And you will feel that coming in your bones as you get older. And as you come closer and closer to your death. And as you face your Maker. And he asks you to give account of what you have done with the magnificent body that he gave you. And what you have done to the people whose bodies they gave you. And God is going to ask you why you have mucked up his world when what he gave you was so great. Face to face with God in the end. The fourth theme is the one I really want to talk about. It's the greatest one of all. It's Christ. You see, God doesn't leave it there by any means. God is concerned for us and for his world and is seeking to rescue us. And he has done it by taking upon himself his own judgment in the person of Jesus. I talked about it last couple of weeks ago. Get the tapes. Robert's been talking about it too. Get the one on what is a Christian, how to become one, or get the one on the death. God actually sends his son into the world and he participates in life. He goes to weddings and is the joy of it. He calls himself the bridegroom of mankind and of his church. He actually perceives himself in those ideas of being united. The whole sexual imagery that's caught up in the Old Testament is used in Jesus to talk about his relationship with his people, because he wants to be united with them. He lives in obedience to God, not in disobedience. He doesn't rebel against God. He doesn't say, God, rack off out of my life, I'm going to do it my way. He says, whatever your will, I will do what you say. And God's will was that he be punished on our behalf. God's will is that he be die our death. God's will was that he take our rap for us, even though he was innocent. That he be cut off from his Father. And so he hung on the cross crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus comes into the world to take the rap for us, but more than that, he rises from the dead, conquering death, that final statement on most of us, conquering that, and pouring out his Spirit upon mankind to make them new, to wash them clean and to make them completely different people. There is a fantastic statement of Paul's in the fourth one that's listed on your sheet there. Just notice that one. Do you not know that the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God? Don't be deceived. Neither sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor male prostitutes, nor homosexual offenders, nor thieves, nor greedy, nor drunkards, nor slanderers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. Don't be deceived. Wrong is wrong. Cut off from God, you'll be cut off from God. Also, don't be deceived in thinking, oh, well, look, I'm not sexually got any of those problems, and so therefore I'll be all right, because there's other things in there too, aren't there, like greed. I've just taken sex as the moment point of illustration today. There's no distinction, though. Rebellion against God is rebellion against God, and if you're rebellious against God, you'll be cut off from God. Don't be deceived. And notice what he says of the Corinthian Christians. And that is what some of you were. Of course they were. All those things. You say, but I've gone so far down the track, there's no way back for me. I can't help it. I'm now almost pathologically involved in adultery. I see a woman, I've just got to get out of bed. That's the first thing that comes to my mind and the second thing that takes place. I mean, I just can't help it anymore. Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Such were some of you. Met Christians who are murderers. I've met Christians who are, you name it, I've met Christians who have done it. Such were some of you. And then comes one of the great words of the Bible. But. In fact, it's repeated three times in the Greek, only once in the English, because they want to make it smooth. I'll read it as it is in the Greek. But you were washed. But you were sanctified. But you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of God. You are not caught up in your past. There is the great but. tremendous statement of God, you see, that you can be changed. The past can be forgiven, and you can be remade as new people with a new future. And how does that take place? Because Jesus has died for you that you may be forgiven. That Jesus has risen to new life and poured out his Spirit upon you, that you can be made pure and holy, and that you can be in right relationship with God. You are made new people. That is what is said. And that is what has been experienced by Christians. That is what I have experienced and people have been experiencing in these last 2 weeks here on this campus. The great alternative of God. You're not caught up as a victim of even your own mistakes. You are freed by what Jesus has done. And so there are two ways to go from this moment on that I want to suggest to you. The one is to investigate.
On the first lecture, I think it was, actually, we had a certain affinity. He was an interesting man. He was a mature age student, and I'm always sorry that I can't remember his name, and I certainly have long lost track of him. He would have been in his mid-30s, I guess. He was a huge man, about 6'5" or so, and he'd wandered the world and been in and out of a thousand things. And, of course, I was fresh out of school, kind of, and just getting to know life. And he was a very interesting man in the many things he taught me and told me and explained to me. And I remember we had morning tea one time over in the Parade Theatre. Is that what you call it now? It used to be called the Union Theatre. What's it on? Is it Footbridge Theatre. That's the one. Yes, well, the Parade's over at New South Wales University. Yes, sorry. At the Footbridge Theatre, there was the coffee thing lounge just there. And we were having morning tea there one day, and he was into Zen Buddhism at that stage in his life. He'd been through many other things. And I had been a Christian for some years, a few years, and we got on talking about Christianity, and he said that the reason he couldn't be a Christian was because when Jesus died, Jesus lost his God consciousness. And I said, really? I mean, how do you know that? He says, because when he died, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? See, he was just at that moment, he lost touch with the divine, with God. And so he wasn't himself fully God. He nearly made it, he says. He made it as close as almost any man has ever made it, but he wasn't totally. He lost it at the last. I was devastated. I'd never heard anything like it in my life. I had no answer to give at all. You know, I just had another cup of coffee. I'm not often caught without words, but there was nothing I could think of to say. It never crossed my mind. And so I went away and I started reading about it. I started trying to think about it and asking people about what this verse meant, because, of course, the crazy part was I'd never even seen that verse there before. Oh, I had. I'd read it at Easter time and all the rest of it, but it never occurred to me what it meant anyway. I didn't know what it meant. And as I wrestled with what this verse meant, I discovered that the very verse for which that man couldn't be a Christian was the very verse which I was a Christian. There's no more important verse, in a sense, in the whole Bible. Because being a Christian is having Jesus die in your place. Having Jesus taking the rap for you. Receiving the punishment of death in your place. That's the very reason, that's what Christianity is all about. Having the perfect substitute who is executed in the place of your execution. And when and how does that happen? It's when Jesus is on the cross and God withdraws from him and he dies. For death is being cut off from God. And that is what happened to Jesus. He was cut off from God. Martin Luther put it in those striking terms, as only Luther could. He said, it's a great mystery, but God deserted God. That is what is happening. You see how massively important God takes my sinfulness and yours to be? What we have done in rejecting God is so serious that it rips God up the middle. Do you see how significant God thinks I am? That he is willing to be separated from his own son, that I may be forgiven.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.